You are listening to WXRW River West Radio, 104.1 FM, and riverwestradio.com all over the world. Hello once again, I'm your host NTSC, and welcome to the Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is, and always has been, and always will be, anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society could look like, while at the same time recognizing that none of us today are truly free. Okay, we're going to dive right into it. Last week, I announced that we were going to be starting a short series called The Anti's Tribute, or The Anti's Salute to Women. The women of the anti-capitalist struggle. Sorry, I'm having some mic issues. The women of socialism, the women of anarchism, etc. I have a fan on me again because even though on day of broadcasts, not super hot, it's really humid. And I'm sweaty. Okay, so last week we listened to Lucy Parsons' address to the very first convention of the Industrial Workers of the World. This week, we're going to be talking about an issue that was first raised on the global stage to real prominence in the 1970s. And instead of me paraphrasing this, this series is going to strive as much as possible to have the women of these movements speak for themselves. So I found a really great article that's been archived by the New Internationalist. Originally appeared in issue 181, and it was first published on the 5th of March in 1988. And it's called Wages for Housework. And it was originally authored by Zoe Fairbairns, who was a novelist and a journalist, whose best-selling novel, Benefits, was partly about wages for housework. So if you're unfamiliar with the wages for housework movement, or what's sometimes referred to as wages against housework, then I'm going to let Zuri Fairbairns do all of the talking about this. It's going to be weird that her words are coming out of my voice, but I'll do my best to read them well. Wages for Housework by Zoe Fairbairns. If women were paid for all they do, there'd be a lot of wages due, sang women campaigners in the 1970s. But demanding money for unpaid domestic work is a sad indictment of the women's movement, argues Zoe Fairbairns, because it demonstrates that feminists have lost the battle to force men to do their share of the cleaning. I am the daughter of a housewife who hated housework. As a child of the 50s and a teenager of the 60s, I watched my mother in horror and guilt and fear. Horror at the unchanging dreariness of the tasks that made her so angry, so tired. Guilt at my own failure to ease her burdens. Fear that her fate would be my fate. It must be my fate. The alternative, staying single, being left on the shelf, was too humiliating to contemplate. I never questioned the equation of marriage with compulsory housework. Why would my mother devote all her time to an activity that made her miserable if she did not have to? Into the anger and anxiety of my late teens came feminism as something contemporary and urgent and speaking to me. It spoke about the politics of housework. The phrase alone was stunning. It brought together what I'd always assumed to be risible and banal, housework, with what I knew to be important and serious, politics. It argued that the division of labor in the home went beyond private family squabbles about whose turn it is to wash up. It argued that without women's unpaid domestic work, world economic systems would collapse. American feminist Pat Mainardi pointed out in The Politics of Housework that even if it takes only 1 hour's work per day to attend to a person's domestic needs, a very low estimate, men who offload this work onto women gain 7 hours per week, almost a whole working day, and women lose those hours. In noting, indignantly, that my father had leisure, earning power, authority, status, and choices, while my mother had housework. I had been right, but I had missed the point. This unfairness was no coincidence. Men's privileges existed because women did housework. Women's liberation writers proposed various remedies. Pat Mainardi thought men should share the housework and suggested how women could bring this about. Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique pointed out how mass media and advertising helped persuade women to accept that domesticity was their destiny. Once we saw through the conditioning, she implied, we would no longer be affected by it. Later, Germaine Greer briskly declared in The Female Eunuch that if women are to effect a significant amelioration in their conditions, it seems obvious they must refuse to marry. No worker can be required to sign on for life. If he did, his employer could disregard all his attempts to gain better pay and conditions. And talking of pay and conditions, in the early 1970s, a feminist group called the Power of Women Collective started campaigning for wages for housework. My first response to the slogan wages for housework was to see it as an extraordinarily good joke. I mean that as a compliment. A good joke is not something absurd or ridiculous. It is something that pleases by evoking the laughter of recognition. Recognition of a truth that has often been thought but never so well expressed. Like, the emperor's got no clothes on. Wages for housework was subversive and embarrassing and enraging and could not go unanswered. Of course, there were and are many answers. Supporters of male privilege are against wages for housework, but then they would be, wouldn't they? No one welcomes the opportunity to pay for what they believe nature has decreed they should have gratis. But many feminists opposed wages for housework too. Arguing, as Lisa Tuttle put it in the Encyclopedia of Feminism, that paying women for child, house, and husband care simply reinforces the very traditions and prejudices that keep women in the home. The basis of the argument has not changed all that much since the 1970s, though times have. The UK political climate of the 1970s was such that, had wages for housework ever become a mass campaign, comparable with campaigns for equality laws, for example, or for the protection of abortion rights, the government might have made a move in that direction. Indeed, it is arguable that they did. Child benefit, introduced in 1976, payable to mothers and financed out of father's income tax, could be seen as a token wage for housework. But under Thatcherism, the fight is on to protect what welfare payments there are. The foreseeable future is unlikely to bring about the introduction of any new ones. And I'll take a pause here to remind listeners that we are reading an essay first published in the New Internationalist in 1988, written by Zoe Fairbairns, called Wages for Housework. And we'll continue. Yet the Wages for Housework campaigners remain vociferous, as do their opponents. Wages for Housework is more than a single demand. It offers a controversial perspective on a wide range of feminist concerns, and the politics and economics of housework have been debated in the context of Greenham Common, campaigns for the right of prostitutes, campaigns against racism, campaigns against rape. What, in the meantime, has happened about the politics and economics of housework in people's homes? How have nearly 20 years of debate on this matter affected the custom under which women donate energy, earning power, and leisure time to men by relieving them of domestic responsibilities? Not very much, according to the UK government's annual Social Trends Survey published in 1986. Men still earn more money and have more leisure than women. Women still do most of the housework, and most married people thought women should do most of the washing, ironing, cooking, and cleaning. Even when couples agree that tasks should be shared equally, by and large, women do them anyway. Or, as my harassed mother used to say, giving up the uneven struggle for fairness at home, it's easier to do it myself. Similar results were found in a less formal survey conducted by Marianne Velmans and Sarah Litvinoff for their book Working Mother, a Practical Handbook, defending themselves against the charge that their book is sexist because its household hints are primarily directed to mothers. They say, as this book is essentially practical rather than campaigning, note the distinction, we are aiming at the average working mother who has the day-to-day running of the house to think about, as well as everything else. We offer all our support and good wishes to any of you planning to change that in your own homes, and we believe that more of us can and will do so. But in the meantime, there is the ironing to be done. And it's easier to do it myself. This mood of resignation to, even acceptance of, inequality in the home permeates the otherwise strong rhetoric and advice of many campaigners outside it. Feminist opponents of wages for housework say that such women would reinforce the assumption that housework and childcare are women's business. But it hardly needs reinforcing. A Labor Party document aimed at capturing the women's vote during the 1987 election had this to say. Women are told they've got equality, but the men who tell them don't understand that most women have to juggle a job, a home, and a family. Have to? A writer in the feminist magazine Women's Review mused recently on one of the ironies of practical feminism. Mothers who wish to leave their kitchens and attain full potential must hire other, less fortunate women to stand in for them. Must? Why? Where are these less fortunate men? Feminist organizers know that if they want events to be well attended, they must provide a creche and time events to take account of women's domestic responsibilities. Whose domestic responsibilities? Why, after nearly 20 years of women's liberation, are feminists accommodating those responsibilities rather than refusing them? Is it because it is easier to make demands of governments, particularly unattainable demands, such as wages for housework, than it is to make them of the person you live with and perhaps love? Strikers negotiating with employers know that if they hold out for too much, scab labor will be found to replace them. An individual woman refusing to marry, live with, cook for, or become pregnant by a man who will not agree to share domestic responsibilities is on her own, with the knowledge that he may find someone more pliable. It may sound hard, but this is what it comes down to. No mass campaign or local authority provision or legal reform can make individual men behave fairly at home if they don't want to, and if individual women won't, can't, or daren't insist. Only a minority of the world's women are in a position to insist. Where domestic labor means not simply buying food and cooking it, but producing it in the first place, refusal could mean starvation. But if feminists who do have some room for maneuver resign themselves to inequality at home and incorporate that inequality into their campaigning strategy, then the debates on wages for housework can be no more than an intellectual exercise. Sex equality in the home will not on its own solve the housework problem, but there can be no solution without it. Zoe Fairbairns is a novelist and journalist whose best-selling novel, Benefits, was partly about wages for housework. So we've got time yet in this episode to talk more about wages for housework, or what's oftentimes referred to as wages against housework, and to talk about some of the social implications of it and the larger movement behind it. And to talk really about this, I think there's three examples I would like to use to... Sorry, man, I'm just having all sorts of mic issues today. I would like to pinpoint three events historically, one which happened in 1975, and then the other two are more contemporary, that specifically point out just how incredibly powerful this movement is. And it's a movement that, although it is couched in the phrase wages for housework or wages against housework, it speaks so much more to the power of women as a class of society than it does to, you know, strictly housework, which has very unfairly been, you know, deemed as, you know, work that's somehow less important than the work that, you know, that is so traditionally reserved for men, you know, factory work, what is often referred to as productive labor. So to begin this discussion, we need to do some scaffolding, and we need to define productive work versus reproductive work. And there is, at least, you know, definitively an answer, or there's a distinction between the two. But essentially, you know, even though one has historically tended to be devalued completely versus the other, they are both fundamentally necessary. They are both crucially necessary to the function of society. I could try and find like a really gross, you know, the Merriam-Webster blah blah, but you know the difference between quote unquote productive labor and reproductive labor. Very basically, reproductive labor is labor that in the capitalist mode of production does not produce what's called surplus value, right? Surplus value being literally the value that can be reaped by the capitalist class. You know, reproductive labor, for the most part, does not produce commodities that have exchange value. You know, they obviously have use value if you're going to go back to your Marx, but essentially, productive labor is what you think is, you know, work traditionally involved with going to a place of work and creating surplus value for your employer. You know, you go to your job at the office, you go to your job at the factory, you go to your job at the warehouse, you know, all that stuff. Reproductive labor, although it does not generate surplus value, it creates an infinite amount of social value. Reproductive labor literally reproduces labor power. You know, so reproductive labor is, for example, the act of bearing children. Capitalism could not exist without that labor, because it literally creates labor power. It creates the working class. You know, a capitalism that, you know, made any, I mean, it's one of the huge contradictions, because, you know, instead of paying women to have children, you know, they're creating the working class that does all of the work for the capitalist class. Women have to shell out tens of thousands of dollars to bear children in this system. We're going to go, so if you remember from episode 48, we read a little excerpt from the essay Our Feminism Must Be Anti-Capitalist by Celeste Mutio and Andrea Deatri. We're going to read just a tiny little sliver from their essay Producing and Reproducing: Capitalism's Dual Oppression of Women. In the 1970s, second wave feminism highlighted the relationship between the private and political spheres. Women questioned what capital had managed to institutionalize and naturalize since the mid-20th century. The separation between the public sphere, production wage labor, and the private sphere, reproduction unpaid labor. The first debates on the role of housework in the capitalist mode of production began. Does housework produce surplus value? Is there a patriarchal mode of production sustained by housework distinct from the capitalist mode of production? Or is there a single capitalist patriarchal system in which reproductive work is determined by and subordinated to the production of exchange value? In 1972, the feminist Marxist autonomist Maria Rosa Dalla Costa and Selma James published The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community in Italy and Britain simultaneously. They claimed that reproductive labor is essential to capitalism and that because it is unpaid, its crucial role is made invisible. Along with Sylvia Federici in New York and Brigitte Galtier in Paris, they founded the International Feminist Collective to advocate this perspective and coordinate actions in various countries through a network of committees for wages for housework. Okay, so think for a second. Could this society work? Could this capitalist mode of production function if all of the reproductive labor that goes on invisibly suddenly ceased? The answer is a definitive and emphatic no. And there's the three historical examples that I mentioned earlier that we'll get to. But let's examine just very briefly some of the examples of reproductive work that make this world function. And if it stopped, everything would fall apart. An example of reproductive work, and all of these, by the way, have historically been associated with women, you know, housewives and mothers in particular. So, the bearing of children. That's first and foremost. You can't have a reserve army of labor if women are not having children. But what has to happen before you have children? You need to conceive children. Sexual labor is part of the kind of the invisible unspoken contract. Women are just supposed to do that. You need to divorce the act of sex, the way that it has historically been dictated by the patriarchy from the role of sex as it has been championed by new feminism. Because obviously, yes, women can enjoy sex, you know, in a good partnership. Sex is fun. It should be fun, but sex is oftentimes referred to as a wifely duty. If you've ever been to a traditional Lutheran marriage, then you hear a lot about women's subservient role to their husband, how they must yield their bodies to their husband when necessary. Sex, for a huge part of human history, has been a labor that has been traditionally the role of women. So let's go on to child rearing, always unpaid. Obviously, we read the example where, you know, women entering the workforce suddenly need to start hiring women who are less privileged to raise their children for them. But for most women, that's still not an option. And also, in the same vein, one of the talking points that the wages for housework movement brings up is if women were actually paid the hourly rate that child care costs, child care is incredibly expensive. And most women who are raising children are doing that for free. And if they were to stop, the entire system would shut the F down. cooking and cleaning, examples of reproductive labor that if it stopped, the whole system would shut down. Cleaning especially, there's a great quote that I love to point out from the anthropologist David Graeber, who I quote all the time on this show, because I like his wit. He says, you know, you make a glass once, you know, there's your productive labor. You've made a glass. You wash that glass 100,000 times or more in its lifespan of use. That's reproductive labor. You are reproducing the means by which people can use and operate that glass. You are reproducing society day after day after day and doing so unpaid. What is unpaid labor? Unpaid labor is slavery. I'll try to stay away from really strong rhetoric like that, but it's slavery. Okay, so while we have a few minutes left here, let's talk a little bit about these three movements, one historical and two contemporary, that pointed out the incredible strength of women. So, okay, it's October 24th, 1975 in Iceland, and the decade of women has begun, and women in Iceland decided that they were going to celebrate the decade of women, as it was announced by the United Nations, by going on strike, and they called it Women's Day Off. Here we go. 25,000 women gathered in the center of Reykjavik, Iceland's capital, for a rally, and most of them just left the women at home, or left the children at home. So by leaving their kids at home for the day, a single day, mind you, they shut down the entire Icelandic economy. They just shut it down just by not doing their housework. It's not like they were striking from their day jobs. They just didn't do the housework or the child rearing. That's it. 90% of the women took part, including women in rural communities. Fish factories were closed because all of the workers there were women. They took a single day off from their unpaid labor and their paid labor, and they shut Iceland down. So let's go to two contemporary movements, the first of which will go to Poland. Okay, so if you know anything about Poland, getting an abortion there is extremely difficult. It was going to be made even more difficult with new legislation that was to be passed in 2016, I think. The women of Poland said nope, and they went on strike from both their paid jobs and, most crucially, their unpaid jobs. More than 150,000 Polish women and more abroad joined in the protest, and it should surprise no one that Parliament capitulated almost immediately and drew back the proposed legislation. Almost immediately, because women en masse went on strike from their paid and their unpaid labor. And then very similarly in 2018 in Ireland, Ireland was going to pass some very dangerous legislation. Oh no, sorry. It was already illegal to get an abortion in Ireland. And women had been pushing for years and years and years to make it happen. And in the last few minutes we have, I'll jump to the conclusion. Irish women went on strike from their paid and their unpaid labor. And even though it did not immediately have the effect, that display of power, that incredible display of reproductive power, would eventually force Ireland to relax some of the incredibly stringent anti-abortion legislation that had been on their books for so very long. Okay, so the wages for labor movement is so much more than what it sounds like on the outset. It is proof positive that anyone who produces, you know, reproductive labor, traditionally these roles that are associated with women and mothers, have the most power, because even though their work is unpaid and undervalued, it is so crucial, and that slavery keeps capitalism running. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Anti here on WXRW River West Radio. I've been your host, Dan TSC, and we'll back again next week with more with our salute to women. Past episodes can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti. More information about the show can be found on riverwestradio.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on WXRW. But first, let's hear from Sandy and see what's going on this week.